You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On Friday and Saturday, the University of Wisconsin-Madison Varsity Band is holding its first spring concert since the start of the pandemic. It'll be the first concert not directed by Mike LaCrone, who retired in 2019 after 50 years leading the band. He started the first spring concert in 1975. The tradition picks up again this weekend. Corey Pompey is the Michael E. LaCrone Director of Athletic Bands and Associate Director of Bands at UW-Madison. He leads the UW Marching Band, conducts the concert band, and teaches classes in the Meade-Witter School of Music. I talked to him yesterday. It's been a couple years since I talked to you, a couple years since you've been on the job. Then COVID happened, and this spring concert, this big first spring concert directed the band, kept getting postponed. How big a deal is it that you get to get the band back together and have this big spring concert?
Well, it's a huge deal. This concert, up until COVID happened, had been going on for 46 years. And so to not continue that tradition was a big blow to all of us. So we're thankful that we have the opportunity again, and we're just excited to get this thing off of the ground.
Now, for those who haven't been able to make it to one of these spring concerts in the past, this isn't just the band showing up and playing. This is has been in the past a big production. Can you talk about why this is such a big show?
Well, you know, it was a big show because there were a lot of production elements that were involved in the show, and we'll certainly have production elements this time. But over the course of the 4 to 6 years, the show just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And perhaps most famously, my predecessor, Mike LaCrone, would fly in and fly above the audience and do different things like that. So there were a lot of those things that were involved with the show, and people really enjoyed those things.
I understand you will not be on wires yourself, and I'm right there with you.
That is correct. I will not be on wires myself.
Now, you haven't been able to do the spring show, but that doesn't mean you haven't done anything. Can you talk about the challenges of running, especially the marching band, during COVID?
Oh my gosh. It where do you want me to start is the question. The worst of it, I shall say, was during the football season when they weren't allowing spectators in the stadium. That was pretty tough for us because we were not doing any public performances. We went an academic year without doing any public performances. That fall semester, we were only able to meet in small groups at a time. So really, until August of 2021, the full band had not been together since the shutdown. And so managing that was a real challenge. Fast forward to the football season of 2021, well, having to deal with what happens when someone contracts COVID. How do we navigate through that? So that was a big challenge. But it pales in comparison to the year when we didn't get a chance to perform for the listening public.
Now, a marching band, I know I was in marching band in high school. It's a community in a lot of ways. Were you able to do things to keep that sense of community and togetherness for the band over those difficult couple of years?
We tried, but I will confess it was very, very difficult because we could not rehearse in large numbers. And so, you know, they didn't get to see each other as much as they're accustomed to seeing each other. And that was one of the things that we heard time and time again during that year, was the sense that there was a loss of community because we couldn't play music together. We couldn't be around each other doing the things that we loved. However, we did what we could, and we operated as best we could under the circumstances.
Now, we had fans back in the stands in the fall. Can you take us back to the first moment when your crew marched out onto the field with, you know, cheering Badger fans?
Oh, there's no way to describe what that moment was like. It was just a joyous occasion for the students in the band. You know, for a large chunk of the band, they never marched in the stadium before. They never had that crowd response. And I must say, that first game back, the crowd was just, they were with us. And we felt it, and we appreciated it very much. And I'm sure they had similar feelings to us. You know, missing out on a full season of football was not fun for those of us that enjoy going into Camp Randall and having those Saturday experiences.
Now, you were, as a band, just like a lot of us in the world, marching in place for a long time there. Do you feel like you're back on track and saying, okay, now we can figure out, you know, what kind of things we want to do, change, expand into the future with this band?
We're getting there. We're not there yet. You know, we're still in the midst of transition and different things like that. And COVID certainly has not helped. But we're well on our way. And hopefully any changes we do make will be, I'm not sure what the correct word is, but any changes won't be perceived by the average listener or the average viewer, because our goal is for the band to be the band, regardless of who's in front of it, who's leading it. We want that ensemble, when they perform, to be recognizable to everyone.
All right, getting back to the spring concert before we're done, I don't know if you want to have spoilers here. What is on the set list for the show?
Oh, okay. Well, certainly the tunes that Badger fans know and love. There'll also be a heavy dose of tunes from the fifth quarter. In addition to that, there'll be a little Panic at the Disco. There'll be a little Queen and some other tunes in there. So hopefully we'll have a variety of music that people in the audience can tap their toes to and enjoy.
Corey, have a great show, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you all for having me.
Corey Pompey is the Director of Athletic Bands and Associate Director of Bands at UW-Madison. He leads the UW Marching Band, conducts the Concert Band, and teaches classes at the Meade-Witter School of Music. He's leading the Varsity Band in the annual spring concert on Friday and Saturday night. Tickets can be purchased at badgerband.com. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings us a story about the importance of community during trying times.
Taking notice and being thankful for the family and community we have around us often occurs when we're facing our most difficult circumstances. Writer Jan Larson brings us an essay about gratitude and the lessons learned on her journey to recovery.
I am standing on the shore, arms at my sides, hands open, palms facing the sea as gentle swells touch the shore. The horizon shows no hint of the storms to come. The first wave laps at my toes. Let's order a CT scan just to be safe, my doctor suggests. A white puff appears, dim on the horizon. Are you driving? Can you pull over? I am in Friday night Minneapolis traffic, heading to an Airbnb where my adult daughter and I will spend the weekend making COVID-19 masks, watching girl movies, and visiting over a bottle of wine. And now, swallowing fear. I'm sorry. The CT scan came back abnormal. We'll schedule an MRI for Monday. The waves cover the tops of my feet. It's a tumor, the neurosurgeon I met moments before tells me. Unable to join me during the office visit, another bit of COVID-19 fallout, My husband, Lauren, phones in from the hospital parking lot. He listens. There is nothing to say. The images tell a story. The tumor measures roughly 3 inches long by an inch wide. It has been there a while, slowly taking up space meant for my brain. My feet melt into the wet sand as the waves cover my ankles. I breathe in and blow out, trying to calm my frantic heart. We are in Rochester with yet another neurosurgeon. He assures us the tumor is benign. We cling to hope. Clouds on the horizon show hints of gray. The seas build, and I brace myself for the waves that splash white foam up my legs. It is early morning. A young resident appears at my bedside. My head is swathed in bandages a la The Mummy. Lauren already knows what I am just learning. The tumor is malignant. A rogue wave crashes the shore. I am knocked to my knees. Drenched, I struggle to regain my footing, determined to face the coming storm. The next 10 days will be consumed waiting to learn whether we have a future. Lauren insists all will be well. I want to believe, but I don't want to make promises I can't keep. I share the image of my lone vigil against the storm with our youngest son. "Mom," he chides me, "you need to rethink that image. You are not alone. Others are on that beach, joining hands, linking arms." What comfort those words bring. I construct visions of rows and rows of friends, family, loved ones, volunteers, medical professionals, and all those who will join me in facing the crashing waves, forming a barrier that surrounds me in love and healing. Another day, another doctor. "You have a rare lymphoma. This is something you will learn to live with, not die from. There will be work ahead. It will be hard, but we can do hard." Storm clouds threaten, but hints of blue appear. I am filled with gratitude for the community that will see me through. I am not alone.
Writer Jan Larson is the chair of the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we talk to the host and reporter behind a new podcast from Wisconsin Watch and WPR that looks at the power prosecutors have in our criminal justice system. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Prosecutors have a lot of power in the criminal justice system, and with that much power concentrated on one side of a criminal case, a prosecutor's decisions can have a big impact on the accused and on the outcome. A new podcast from Wisconsin Watch and WPR takes a closer look at the role of the prosecutor through the lens of a number of criminal cases here in Wisconsin. It's called Open and Shut. It is out today. Phoebe Petrovic is the host and reporter behind Open and Shut. Phoebe, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the legal expert you talked to in the first episode. This is Angela J. Davis from American University. To clarify, not the activist Angela Davis, talking about the power prosecutors have in this clip. Here's a listen.
Police officers can only bring individuals to the courthouse door. It is the prosecutor who decides whether that individual will remain in the system and what they'll be charged with.
Phoebe, tell us more about what makes prosecutors such important players in the system and why it matters.
Yeah, so Angela Jordan Davis is a brilliant legal scholar reporting and researching the power of prosecutors. And she tells us that prosecutors are the most powerful actors or officials in the criminal justice system because they have two main powers: the power to bring charges, which is what you heard in that clip, and the power to broker plea deals. So whereas a police officer can pull you over or arrest you, it's the prosecutor who decides whether or not you are actually going to face criminal charges based off of that arrest. arrest. And then through the ability to choose which charges, you know, that carry particular sentences, how many charges, and offer a plea deal, they really have the power to decide in some ways how long you will be entangled in the system. Plea bargaining happens in the vast majority of cases in Wisconsin and across the country. And so that means that the trial that people facing criminal charges, quote unquote, receive often takes place, in fact, in the prosecutor's office. And that's a paraphrase from the Center for Public Integrity, instead of in a courtroom before a jury of your peers.
You look at the issues through the lens of a couple different prosecutors, past and present. One is Vince Biskupic. Can you introduce us to him?
Absolutely. So Vince Biskupic is one of two prosecutors in the Fox Valley that we focused on, using them as a lens through which to view this larger system. Vince Biskupic is a former district attorney from Outagamie County. He came into office in 1994. Prior to that, he had most recently been the deputy district attorney in Winnebago County. And Biskupic was the DA in Outagamie County from 1994 to 2002. Now, that's an elected position. So he was the chief elected prosecutor in the county, bringing cases on behalf of the state. And his career as a prosecutor ended in 2002 when he unsuccessfully ran for attorney general against Peg Lautenschlager.
What are some, can you introduce us to some of the cases that Biskupic was involved in?
Absolutely. So we look at, you know, a half a dozen criminal cases that were considered sort of high profile cases from his career. These include an arson case, several homicide cases from Kokana, a rape case. So it really sort of spans the gamut of high level felony cases. In all of those, he gained convictions. In some of these cases that we look at, those convictions were challenged in appeals courts. And in two cases, they were convictions were either withdrawn or overturned.
You find in some cases accusations of irregularities in what prosecutors do, both Biskupic and Joe Paulus, another one, accusations that they handled things wrong in one way or another. What were some of the common elements that you ran into?
Sure. So a lot of our reporting focused on discovery. And so discovery is one of the most important aspects of any type of litigation. In a criminal case, that means the exchange of information between the prosecutor and the defense. And when you think about a criminal case, the defendant, you know, is facing off against a prosecutor who has the police on their side, has potentially the state crime lab involved. So there's a lot of evidence that the state has and that statutes require the prosecutor to disclose. But one of the sort of structural problems is that the statute, the Wisconsin discovery statute, doesn't specify exactly when the prosecutor has to turn over the information they have to turn over. And they don't necessarily have to do it prior to plea bargaining. And so many of the cases that we look at, sort of spanning the series, have in one way or another allegations of information or important evidence being improperly withheld. And the importance of that is that it, you know, it means that there isn't, that the defendant isn't able to argue their cases properly, or, you know, maybe they took a plea deal when they might have gone to trial to fight their case, or their defense attorney isn't able to cross-examine the witness or a witness as effectively as they might have if they had all the information that the prosecutor had at their disposal.
And speaking of witnesses, another common theme in the first couple episodes is another power prosecutors have to get somebody to offer their witness testimony against somebody being charged. They can offer that other person a nicer plea deal if they happen to be accused of a crime. How common is that tactic?
You know, that's common, and that also is perfectly legal and the standard practice. It's perfectly acceptable for that to happen. One of the problems we saw in our reporting, and that is pretty well documented, is the problem is if that incentive or if that deal isn't disclosed to the defense and to the jury. So often if a witness comes to testify against a co-defendant, let's say at a trial, there are standard questions that a prosecutor asks, you know, have we promised you a deal? Are you doing this of your own volition? Things like that. And sometimes that's very well the case. The problem in the cases that we've uncovered is potentially that not being disclosed.
One thing that struck me is a lot of times people are worried about wrongful convictions, the wrong person being put in prison for a crime. You also look at people who almost certainly did the crime they were accused of. Why is it important to focus on prosecutorial potential misconduct, even in those cases?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something I came up against while reporting this series a lot, from people saying, this person is so guilty. Why does it matter? Why do we care? And the answer that I got from law professors, people who study this for a living, people who are criminal defense attorneys themselves, they say it matters because we have to test the integrity of our system against the hard cases, even the brutal cases. You know, one law professor who told me this had just come back from overviewing military commissions hearings in Guantanamo Bay. And she's like, it's really important that we have due process for everyone in our system, because if we're not doing it in those cases, we're not doing it at all. And some of the cases we've, you know, we had potential allegations, or we had allegations that, you know, a person, you know, admitted to being part of a homicide, but potentially was due, you know, potentially could have benefited from a slightly lower sentence, depending on whether or not all the information was disclosed. So for some people, you know, this can mean the difference between dying in prison or having the chance at parole. And then we also talked to, you know, friends and family members of crime victims or people who testified in criminal trials as witnesses, who said, you know, I'm totally convinced that this person is guilty, and I really want that conviction to stick. And so if there was anything in the prosecution of this case that undermines the integrity of that conviction, that's a problem for me, because then I'm not so secure and I don't have closure. And so it's important to do that right.
Thanks to Phoebe Petrovic, creator of the Open and Shut podcast. You can check out the Open and Shut podcast online wherever you get your podcasts, or head over to WPR.org/openandshut. The first three episodes are active right now. Get it online at WPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a mining company has the go-ahead to do some exploratory drilling for copper and gold in northern Wisconsin. We'll get two perspectives. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an infectious disease doctor gives us some advice after the overturning of a federal public transportation mask mandate. First, the return to full-time in-person learning for students this year has brought more behavioral issues in some districts. At the start of the school year, the Madison School District saw a sharp rise in behavioral referrals for fighting in its high schools, according to an analysis by the Wisconsin State Journal. And some districts around the country have reported similar numbers since the fall compared to pre-pandemic years. It's not clear how widespread that trend is, given that there's no statewide or nationwide data. But the reports from some districts are raising concerns about safety and the way students are readjusting to in-person learning. Our guest today is here to help us better understand the ways that students respond to anger and how to help them process their emotions more effectively and peacefully. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in a school district? Are you seeing more fights or other behavior problems in your schools this year? Are students acting out more in general? What do you think is driving that? If you're a parent or a student yourself, what are you seeing? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan Martin is a professor of psychology and associate dean for the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at the UW-Green Bay. His research focuses on healthy and unhealthy expressions of anger. You can follow his work at alltheragescience.com. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Does it surprise you that we're hearing from at least some schools that they're seeing more fights and behavioral problems from students since the return to in-person learning?
It does not surprise me much at all. I don't know that I would have anticipated the problem being as severe as it seems to be, but I do think that we're seeing more anger just generally across a variety of contexts. And so I think, to me, that there are some things that might be unique to the school situation, but Overall, I think this is really a symptom of a much broader anger problem that we're seeing right now in the United States and maybe elsewhere as well.
Before we dig deeply into schools and the teenage years and anger, what do you see driving that wider trend toward us being more angry?
I think there are a lot of factors at play right now. I think, stress over the pandemic and the uncertainties that stem from that are still very present for people. And I think that stress is making it more likely for people to snap at times. I think the fact that we are still, we've relatively recently had a very, very divisive election, and one that I think, all elections have been divisive, but I think this one didn't go away, right? That there is still a lot of discussion about it. There's still a lot of questions about sort of what's going to happen next with the upcoming elections. I think we're in a very divisive political time that tends to be driving a lot of negativity and a lot of frustration. And I think a lot of the kind of economic and other types of uncertainty that we're living in right now is maybe encouraged a level of competitiveness amongst people that is driving anger.
Now, diving back into schools, those factors are there for everybody. They're there for teenagers. And on its own, being a teenager can be a tough time to live through without all that stuff you just mentioned. Are people at that high school age particularly vulnerable to those things that can drive more anger?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of things about being a teenager that are particularly challenging that can lead to anger. And so, for starters, we have a lot of the developmental elements, the physiological developmental changes associated with puberty that can lead to increased emotionality in general. We also have the fact that parts of the brain associated with impulse control are not fully developed yet. So we've got this situation where there's a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, a lot of emotionality, and some, I guess, poor impulse control. And I think that, all of those things sort of build into this perfect storm that lead to fights and other forms of aggression.
Now, fighting in schools isn't new. There were fights, in my junior high, in my high school, but not infrequently, I'll say, not all the time. Have we learned lessons about creating school environments that help to prevent that? Are there things we should be trying that you think about?
Yeah, I think, the impulse oftentimes is to punish, and that is what a lot of people will say. And it's not that I don't believe in accountability. I do, but I'm not sure that, stricter rules are necessarily going to get us there. I think most teenagers know that fighting is against the rules and that a punishment will ensue. And I don't think that stops them in the moment. I think one of the things that we can do to limit fighting is to start recognizing those conflict and tension states before they happen. And that a lot of fights very rarely happen out of nowhere, where it's just two strangers who start fighting. That does happen, but that isn't the most common. I think oftentimes what we see is that there's a buildup. And I think that being able to recognize that buildup, being able to identify some of the signs there, and then intervene earlier can be really helpful. And I think even when they are somewhat spontaneous, even when they do happen amongst strangers, there's still some tension prior to that from the parties involved. And if we can do a good job of identifying that and moderating and mediating that, I think we're going to be in better shape.
We're talking to Ryan Martin, psychology professor at UW Green Bay, looking at reports from some school districts of an increased number of fights and other behavioral problems since in-person schooling started. And more general issues of anger and anger management for teenagers and the rest of us. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences in a school this year at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan, for parents, are there things they can do to help give their kids, like a toolkit to take their anger and not use it in harmful ways?
Yeah, I think, again, the impulse is sometimes to punish here. And I think that, again, I get the need for accountability, but I also think that focusing on a few other approaches is going to be really important. So first is, I think, modeling. I think one of the best things parents can do is demonstrate for their kids how to appropriately handle anger. And so, you know, not yelling themselves, not being aggressive themselves, finding ways to just stay in control in front of their kids and to their kids can go a long way. I also think it's important to identify that anger when it happens and not to send the messages to kids that the emotion itself is the problem. I think that there are a lot of good reasons for kids to be feeling frustrated right now. I think they have come off an extraordinarily stressful couple of years. There's been a lot of anxiety and a lot of worry. And so to not minimize the feelings, to acknowledge those feelings can go a long way to helping kids learn to deal with anger and then help them channel those feelings into more productive, positive solutions. So if you've got a child who is angry about something, teaching them to have an assertive conversation and even maybe sort of role-playing ways of handling that, all of those can be good, healthy ways of dealing with anger at home.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Wausau. Tim, hi. Tim is not with us in Wausau. Maybe you can call back in, Tim, at 800-642-1234. Ryan, something I've talked to you about a time or three, I think a lot of people might look at a solution to anger being express it, vent it, punch pillows and that sort of thing. This is something I think you push back on a lot.
Yeah, it's that myth is so prominent, we even have a name for it. It's called the catharsis myth, and it's the belief that punching pillows and punching bags and going to rage rooms and releasing, quote unquote, our anger those ways is going to be a good way to deal with it. And every piece of data we have says that, no, that's not effective. In fact, it makes us angrier. It makes us more likely to be aggressive in those provoking moments. And so I think moving away from those approaches and trying to channel it into more productive approaches is really valuable.
We're talking to UW Green Bay psychology professor Ryan Martin about student fights at schools, some districts reporting an increase compared to pre-pandemic, and how teenagers are dealing with emotions and with conflict since returning to full-time in-person learning. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think this is happening, at least in some districts? Do you have a firsthand look at these issues in a school? Are you seeing this? Are you not seeing this where you are? What are your questions about how we deal with anger or your own solutions? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about how the pandemic has affected the way students process emotions and conflict, with some districts saying they're seeing more fights and other behavioral concerns in schools now compared to pre-pandemic numbers. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on that, your perspectives if you're seeing it in your local school as a student, a parent, a teacher, administrator. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Patty is with us in Green Bay. Patty, hello.
Hi, I am a teacher in a local school district, and I can tell you that I'm absolutely seeing this, and it is my impression that it's being very much underreported because I don't think they want people to really know how bad things are.
Patty, is it affecting your ability to teach, do you think?
It's affecting my ability to even just be in the building. It's actually dangerous for me, and I don't feel safe.
Patty, and can I ask what age range you teach? Are you at a high school?
At a lower grade, and that's all I would be willing to say.
Gotcha. Patty, thank you for calling in and sharing that. Ryan, you know, if this is interfering with the education and making teachers feel unsafe, I don't know. Do you think we're taking this seriously enough?
Yeah, I have grave concerns about where things are at for a variety of reasons. I mean, we've focused on the safety of students right now, but I think also focusing on the safety and well-being of teachers. You know, this is happening within the context of teachers who appear to be leaving the profession in high numbers, or at least considering leaving the profession in high numbers. And this has to add to that. And so my sense is that we need to be taking this seriously for a whole lot of reasons. I would also add that I wonder the degree to which the inadequate or potentially inadequate resources of schools might be playing a role here too. We know that when kids have good positive relationships with their teachers, they're less likely to engage in some of the types of aggression we're talking about. And, you know, I think higher class sizes mean it's harder to develop those relationships.
Patty, thanks for calling in. We'll go next to Leo in Milton. Leo, hi.
Hi there. I'm a current senior in high school, so I kind of got a chance to see, you know, before COVID, high school, during and after. And I think it's a really stark difference with how, like, especially the underclassmen are, like, with how they act and, like, acting out. I can really see how, like, the COVID experience has changed, like, teenagers' minds internally and almost, like, set many of them back.
Leo, do you feel like you made the adjustment? Okay, I assume you had some time out of school and you're back in now. How did it go for you personally, if I may ask?
Yeah, I mean, I think it went well for me just because I had that, you know, freshman year before COVID. So I got that chance at like a real high school experience before COVID started, which I think without that, it would not have been as good as it is now. So I think I really got lucky. Yeah, with that, but like my friends, underclassmen are like, I can tell they're struggling with the transition to high school, even as like sophomores.
Interesting, Leo. Thank you so much for sharing that perspective. Ryan, I mean, people talk about, you know, kids having a lost year or lost couple of years, and it can be hard to come back from that.
Yeah, I think that was a really important point made, and I'm thankful for the call. I think that we have to remember that, a year and a half, if that's, which for many students, that's about what this was, a year and a half in of high school or of school is a pretty significant portion of your educational time. And it's going to impact not just the academic learning, but the social learning as well. And I think that that is undoubtedly playing a role. And I think it's probably playing a role in the broader context of anger right now as well, that people just are a little bit out of practice. It's not just the stress. It's the minimal human interaction over the last few years. And so I think that's definitely relevant.
Leo, thanks again for calling in and sharing that. Aaron joins us now in Neenah. Aaron, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am a high school teacher, and I especially work with students that are, you know, teen parents and high risk. I have seen a lot of students complaining or coming to me saying that their needs just can't be met at home right now. You know, we have a lot of parents that their job never quite recovered. They're not quite making what they were before the pandemic. Food prices are really high. Rent prices are really high. Gas prices are really high. So these kids have not just gone through, you know, the year and a half of pandemic, but now are dealing with, you know, we're supposedly through it or getting through it, and things still aren't better for them. They still don't have food. They still don't have support. So I understand where a lot of the frustration is coming from. I don't know how to help it, however. And I'm wondering how we can help not only the anger, but also the apathy that seems to be right alongside it.
Aaron, thanks a lot. A lot there, Ryan. What do you think?
Yeah, I think a lot of what the caller speaks to is some of what I identified at the beginning, which is, you know, I don't think that young people are worried about the economy the same way their parents are. But those economic factors I was talking certainly have an indirect and even direct impact on their life, the way the caller is describing. And, you know, that there's that if they're not having their basic needs met, if they are hungry and if they're not able to get enough sleep at night, or if they're not having a healthy relationship with their parents or their siblings, or there's a lot of stress at home, all of that influences how they are at school. And so that's, I think, undeniable that those things are sort of trickling into the classroom and making problems worse. You know, I think that it's hard to know what to do, because the solutions to many of those problems are political solutions. They aren't things that parents necessarily have the power to fix, or teachers necessarily have the power to fix, even though that's where we sort of put the pressure on and say, well, this is where we need to fix it. I don't think that's true. I think these are political factors.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Ryan Martin from UW Green Bay, psychology professor there, about anger, about some increased fights reported by some school districts around the state and the country. Let's go back to your calls now. Barry is with us in Madison. Barry, hi.
Good afternoon. I've got a comment and a question. First of all, ever since schools have begun, there's been fights in school. It's not new, but it certainly has increased in number. And second point is that all of us go through elementary school and we have one teacher primarily. And human beings have an absolute necessity to have relationships. But when we get to middle school, when kids are starting to move into puberty, all of a sudden each kid has 5, 6, 7 different teachers every day. Now, if we expect kids to develop relationships, it's very difficult to do that within our structure. And the last point is that when you factor in all of these social issues, putting 2,000 kids or 4,000 kids in a building is certainly not conducive to living. And my question is, how do we address that?
Barry, thanks for the call. Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm really intrigued by the idea and what the caller said about, being able to build those relationships and have the same teacher throughout. You know, I understand there are practical barriers there, but I assume that some of those practical barriers can be addressed with. I agree. I mean, in the sense that I think that relationship building with students is a really important element here, and our system might not be set up perfectly for that. I also agree that the class size is relevant. I mean, I think the caller referenced building size, mm-hmm. and how many students are at a particular school. I would even localize that to say I think that class size is relevant, that it becomes more complicated. The more kids you're going to have in a building, the more kids in a lunchroom, and the higher the student-teacher ratio, all of those things are going to drive the potential for conflict.
Thanks for that call, Barry. In just our last minute or so, Ryan, we've heard from one high school student. If there are others listening, what are your thoughts that you'd want to leave them with when it comes to dealing with the emotion that we all have, anger?
Yeah, I think that I would sort of implore kids to understand that the anger they're feeling might be absolutely justified. There are lots of things to be angry about. And a lot of times that anger isn't happening on its own. It's coming along with some sadness and some anxiety and some stress and a whole bunch of other complicated emotions. I think what I would encourage kids to do is to try and find ways to talk to caregivers, talk to teachers, to try and connect with people. I think that the isolation they've experienced has been causing a lot of this, and to try and find ways to connect with people on a deeper level. That is really difficult, hard work, and I congratulate them for their willingness to try. But I think that's where the solutions are going to come from right now.
Ryan, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ryan Martin, professor of psychology and associate dean for the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at UW Green Bay. Follow his work at alltheragescience.com. He was with us today looking at how social isolation during the pandemic might be affecting how students behave in schools, with some districts reporting more fights and other disruptions. Coming up after the news, a federal judge has overturned the mask mandate for planes, trains, buses, and other mass transit. An infectious disease doctor shares some thoughts on staying safe while traveling. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.